Atreides house is building a secret army using a technique unknown to us, a technique involving sound.
It is by will alone I set my mind in motion.
Hello and welcome once again to the Intermillennium Media Project podcast. My name is Matthew Porter.
And I'm Ian Porter.
I'm his dad. He's my son. And we thought we had this timed so perfectly.
We thought we did.
You're actually listening to this sometime after we recorded it because
And not in the way all of them are.
Yes.
If you somehow ever listen to an episode of our show before we recorded it, please tell us. It will make editing so much easier.
Yes. That end, I'm going to need a better security system.
Yes.
Maybe we're just seeing all possible branching timelines. But this is being released months after we recorded it. Because our plan was that just as in the year 2021, we greeted the release of Denis Villeneuve's adaptation of Dune with a podcast about the Frank Herbert novel, Dune, we would greet the release of Villeneuve's Dune Part 2 with a discussion of the 1984 David Lynch adaptation of Dune.
Oh, goodness, Lynch Dune. David Lynch Dune is such a thing.
But now we find out that, no, it's not going to be released in December. It's going to be released a few months from now. But apparently we weren't the only ones who were taken by surprise by this, or who had planned otherwise, at least, because the Alamo Drafthouse was having a special screening of David Lynch's Dune, and we couldn't pass up the chance to see this on a big screen.
We couldn't not see this there. So, we've already discussed kind of the shadow over all of media that each of us has encountered of Dune, this grand thing that is simultaneously understandable and impenetrable, that is too great to deal with, but also too silly to not talk about. I kind of want to talk about this version specifically in our preamble here.
Sure.
Because this is how I knew of the concept of David Lynch before I'd seen any other thing that was David Lynch.
That's probably true for a lot of people. There are probably a lot of people who had not seen Eraserhead, who had not seen The Elephant Man, and whose first David Lynch film was Dune.
My kind of cognizant recollection of the concept of David Lynch became at first, there's this silly thing on the internet, Dune, that this guy directed. And then it was, oh, and my dad has made references to what sounds like the same guy who did that doing his version of X-Files called Twin Peaks? Huh. I wonder what that is. And now later on, here we are, years later, and I'm here going, oh yeah, find me more things inspired by Twin Peaks. Yes, please. Oh, I like all these, I like grand fantasy and sci-fi novels which blend the two and try to incorporate giant worlds that sometimes get compared to Dune. Yeah, I've fallen right down this rabbit hole, right down the pit into the mouth of the sandworm of this kind of content. And I'm like, okay, I'm ready on both sides. Show it to me.
Well, as long as we're talking about David Lynch and impressions of David Lynch, before I saw this version of Dune, I had seen his Elephant Man movie.
Okay.
And was very impressed by it. Thought that was really, really a good movie. Very strange and different, and yet a comprehensible narrative. A good film. Then I saw Dune, and my reactions to Dune, which we'll talk about at length, were more about how I felt about this movie, having been a longtime fan of the novel.
Okay.
And then I think the next David Lynch movie I saw after that was Eraserhead.
Okay.
And that led me to write a long letter to several of my friends in gaming amateur press associations, explaining my detailed plan and seeking funds for us to have David Lynch voluntarily stranded on a remote island with a selection of cameras and lenses and a supply of film stock and several hundred Morlocks who were trained in set design and construction, and let him stay there and make all of his movies without having to interact with the rest of society.
Oh, don't let him touch anything.
I didn't get enough funding or permission from Mr. Lynch for that to happen. But then I saw Blue Velvet, and I was a David Lynch fan at that point and followed all of his stuff after that.
Okay.
So it was a weird and complicated relationship I had with David Lynch, and this came in the beginning of that early stage of how I felt about David Lynch.
Oh, yeah. You introduced me to so much of it, so I can't even, like, compare. So I'm a fan through your fandom in that sense. But here I am, like, being excited anytime I see weirdness on the internet being shorthanded with red curtains and a zigzag floor. And I'm here, like, diving headfirst into, like, Remedies games, which are practically interactive David Lynch films. Yeah, they are very much interactive David Lynch films and such, so I'm diving headfirst into those, and I'm always excited by that kind of weird little details and picking it apart things. There's so many point-and-click adventure games that take his style and want to use them.
And he is one of those rare artists whose name has become the name, if not of a genre, the maybe, definitely of a style.
And it's a style that is simultaneously on its own, like, entirely itself, and kind of oddly compatible with other things. Like, a David Lynch version of a thing makes sense more often, I think, than other directors. He can be all on his own alongside a property if you were to hand it to him.
Yes.
Which is part of what it's interesting of seeing him tackle Dune. This is just completely aside. Now that Nintendo is announcing that they're making more movies of their other properties than Mario, I am crossing my fingers that the impossible would happen and they'd somehow get David Lynch to do a Kirby movie. It would fit too well. Bright happiness that somehow devolves into existential terror that people just smile at and defeat with friendship. I think it could work.
I'm pausing here because I'm not entirely sure that David Lynch hasn't already made a Kirby movie, and he called it Eraserhead.
Oh, it is? Okay. I might...
I'm not sure, but I think that's a possibility here.
Okay. I'm gonna have to watch that later. But we're here to talk about Dune.
We are. Because when I watched this, I didn't think of it as a David Lynch movie. I thought of it as a big-budget adaptation of Dune, and your mom and I saw this on its opening night in 1984, because we had both read Dune and were fans of the book. The early press about this movie was not good, but we couldn't not see it. We couldn't not see what Hollywood had done with Dune.
And you made sure that I had a similar experience here, because one of the first things as we're coming up to the theater, you did, was hand me something.
Yes, I handed you... Uh-oh. The shield wall is down. No, actually, it's just Ian's microphone stand.
Okay, we're back.
I handed you a reprint of what had been handed to me and Mrs. Darling Wife, at that time Miss Lovely Girlfriend, as we entered the theater to see Dune. It was a double-sided sheet of paper of Dune terminology.
Yes.
And it was this glossary of all the strange terms that were used in the movie, most of which were from the book. But they handed us this double-sided glossy sheet of paper, and it was printed like dark gray on a half-toned desert background, and they handed this to us as we were on our way into a dark movie theater to watch a movie. And this was not an Alamo Drafthouse back in 1984, so there were no convenient lights under the table by which we could read these. What exactly these were supposed to achieve, I'm not sure. Were we supposed to stand outside the movie theater and memorize these before we went in to see the movie?
I don't know. And I'm fascinated by the fact that some of the terms that are on this are things that I can't tell if I just know from changes in popular culture, from changes in terminology overall, because I am soaked in nerd culture with thanks to you and mom and everything else, it's like, I don't know. I know Ornithopter. That just doesn't seem like I need to have it on this, but they don't have Landstrat. And I'm like, Landstrat. And I'm like, it feels off. Yes. On this terminology sheet, there's things missing and things included that I can't tell if it's just because I'm as old as Magic the Gathering, and that has taught me all sorts of fantasy things very quickly, and this we're just not as popularly known, or maybe just because I live in the age of the internet, and I've been able to sit and absorb wikis as a way to clear my head. You know, I don't know, it's, you know, it's 2 a.m., I can't sleep, I guess I'm going to learn all of the Resident Evil franchise. That's the sort of thing I can do nowadays, which wasn't available to you, but that yes. means I might have more odd reference material in my own mind to use, and I don't know.
Yeah, some of these terms have just are in the lexicon because they're words, and others, Dune has had so much more influence in the generations that have followed that they've crept into other kinds of pop culture. You'll find references to these things, most of which come to whatever other media they're in, not from their origins, but from the way Dune used them.
Yeah, am I used to making 1/1 flying Thopter tokens in Magic the Gathering because of or in parallel to Dune?
Oh, and
that's a whole other discussion.
A whole other discussion is Magic the Gathering as a hub for cultural references. Because it will shamelessly and delightfully pull from all kinds of novels and movies and comics and reuse these terms in a way that both puts them together and could lead a curious person down a path to find these other things, starting with Magic. And that's a card game is uniquely suited to that because everything is broken up into little pieces already. You can have these discrete references that don't have to tie together, but they'll tie back to what they came from.
Mm-hmm. So here we are with this reference catalog going into a movie that purports to condense the entirety of that book into a single thing, and you're walking in with that into a dark theater. I can just imagine how absolutely unparsable the entirety of what you're about to experience is. If you have no frame of reference.
Yeah. Having the frame of reference from the book made me really concerned that they were trying to put all of this into 2 hours and 17 minutes. If you didn't have the book, I don't think that sheet of paper was going to help you if you didn't already have some of that knowledge. But I think mostly that sheet of paper, it showed that Universal Pictures was kind of nervous and panicky. And they had spent a lot of money on this and was afraid that it was going to be a horrible failure and wondered how they could not just sell more tickets, but keep people from walking out on opening night. We've got to give people a frame of reference here. Here's a glossary. Please study this and you'll enjoy the movie more.
But I was when the film started up now in the Alamo there, I was actually surprised and impressed. It was doing pretty well, compacting everything together. It was relying on different shorthands. We were just talking about the references, and I immediately said, oh, there's a lot more of the way they're presenting Paul's family, and they're presenting, honestly, everything that is leaning on the Arthurian royal houses. You know, fantasy elements instead of the, you know, sci-fi elements.
Yes.
I'm going to have to compare to the new one for a moment. The new one expects that you've seen a bunch of Star Wars.
Yes.
This one thinks you've seen a bunch of Camelot and Crow.
Right.
And that right there is such a difference.
Yeah. They were in 1984, they were more competing with Star Wars and the memory of Star Wars. Then they were relying upon it as part of your cultural context. Whereas, as you say, they are relying upon the fact that you've seen Camelot. I think you make a great point, because I think there's more that connects this movie to John Borman's Excalibur than the presence of Patrick Stewart.
Yes, very much so. And the casting is very interesting in this.
Yeah, I would say that the casting is uneven.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts from their casting of Paul Atreides. on the one hand, Kyle MacLachlan is, I think, a superb actor.
Yes.
And he works, as history has shown, he works extremely well with David Lynch. And there are a lot of things that he got right about the character of Paul Atreides. He no matter what he does, he was about 24 when he was making this movie, and he looked every day of 24, and that's too old for Paul Atreides. Paul Atreides was supposed to be not yet really a man at the beginning of this story, and I can't look at Kyle MacLachlan in his first scene and not see a full-grown man who's in graduate school.
Yeah. The actual story of Dune is about a much more confused young man.
Yeah.
This one is about a bit more of an older and bit more experienced and competent guy in that sense, which helps the fact that they're trying to speed up the plot.
Yes.
By making him skip over some of Paul Atreides, the book character's missteps and stumbles and difficulties. And I almost feel like the older casting let them get away with that by explaining him as being over it and being able to handle it better.
Yeah, and that robs the story of so much of its power. Dune was a story of coming of age, in which the coming of age was sent in weird directions by a combination of drugs and strange religion, which actually describes a lot of movies that were made in the 60s.
Yeah.
But, and that's where Dune comes from. But, you know, there's not enough room for that growth because he's already grown.
I will say that with that compression, it turns the story of Dune into a fascinating other example where it emphasizes the what if everyone's chosen run narrative was real and they all were about one guy. Everything goes wrong or right, depending on how you look at it.
Ah.
Because we've got, you're the chosen one to be my heir and legacy to this throne. You're the chosen one to be the Kwisatz Haderach. You're the chosen one to lead the Fremen. You're the chosen rival of this one person from the rival house. And when all of those are the same guy, suddenly he's got an army, authority, a group of power, and a person to fight to prove it all.
And worshippers.
And no one expected him to have all those other parts when they labeled him the chosen one for their thing.
I like that. That's great. Yes, he's your chosen one, but not only your chosen one.
What? He's no. He's the chosen one, period. For all of them.
Anybody been chosen, it's him.
Exactly. And that kind of, he's the confluence and everyone is surprised by someone else having picked him as well, comes through a lot more when his rise to power and his defeat of the empire of this grand empire that's been running space for all this time is this much faster when he kind of just shows up and takes over.
Yes.
And does the thing and wins this swiftly. Everyone seems more confused in story as well as out.
And that, of course, includes Paul, and they removed from this so much of the emotional tension of Paul's arc. It's not just him coming of age, but it's his, when the spice affects him and he can see into the future, he sees the paths that he is going to take. He sees what's going to be done in his name with this galactic jihad and is horrified by it and is powerless not to bring it about. And this movie, to jump ahead, they just talk about, well, he eventually is recognized as the Kwisatz Haderach, and he's going to spread an empire of peace and unity across the galaxy.
As it's he like, stands...
Yeah, that's not...
Yeah, stands over the guy he just stabbed and then yelled hard enough to crack the foundations of the building. He will bring peace and love. That's... Okay, then.
It is absolutely no slight to MacLachlan's performance that he wasn't well cast in this role, and then the role wasn't written super well as far as the story arc goes.
Mm-hmm. I will say they did a very good job of keeping the political intrigue first half very readable.
Yes.
In this. And I was very impressed with that, because the establishment of these two houses being two of the many houses of the emperor and his style and his grand presence were well established. the fact that there's these other forces of the Navigators Guild and the Bene Gesserit witches all coming in and kind of having their influence on his court was all very well established.
Very well done.
And even when they have to have, like, someone in here is a traitor, they immediately tell us who it is. But seeing everyone go through the, well, he's holding something back. But that mark means he's trusted by the Emperor, so it can't be him. They do all of those little things to keep the suspense and the revenge plot very well structured.
And there is a lot of basic information you need to get. And they took a trope right from the novel by having the introduction, an introductory voiceover prologue by the Princess Irulan, who we know from the books becomes Paul Muad'Dib's historian. And she explains who the houses are and where what the planets are and what are the importance of them. And I'm usually not a big fan of voiceover prologues in movies. I say, if you want to make a movie, make a movie. Show us things. But in this, because it fit with the source material, because it fit with the idea of this being a history of epic events, I thought it was done very well. Mm-hmm. I kind of wish they had done that more. I wish they had broken the movie up into sections more and given us little summaries by Irulan. We don't get that again until late in the movie when it seems like an act of desperation.
Yeah.
And they realize, oh gosh, we spent a lot of time up to this point. We've got too much story to go. Let's skip over a bunch and have Irulan tell us what would happen in the 90 minutes of movie we're cutting out. And then we'll move on later.
Yeah, they could have sprinkled her in more, and that seems odd to say, but instead she feels like the hand of the cutting room reaching up and grabbing a chunk of movie and dragging it away from us.
Yes. But we were talking about casting. Some of the other casting I thought was very good.
Yes.
I think Jürgen Prochnow as Duke Leto and Francesca Anise as Lady Jessica. I thought they were excellent.
Excellent, yeah.
I think that the portrayal of Jessica in this movie, I prefer it so much to the portrayal of Jessica in Villeneuve's movie, because here Jessica seemed appropriately frightened for her son and her Duke while still having extreme control because of her training. Whereas the portrayal of Jessica in the newer movies, she seems terrified and panicky and desperately clinging to this training that apparently hasn't done a lot of good. They're different choices. I much prefer Francesca Anise's choices in terms of how to play Jessica. And I'd say that the portrayals of Duke Leto were comparable in the two different movies, but I thought Jürgen Prochnow was really good at that combination of strength and compassion and being a Duke who's concerned for his people and his house, but also concerned for his son.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, Patrick Stewart, Dean Stockwell, Max von Sydow, and even Freddie Jones and Richard Jordan acting as the court for Leto with all their different things, they play it. So I want to say it's Shakespearean. All of them have that kind of extra gravitas.
Yes.
And all of them play their role with this presence where when they stand in a line, and you were just take a still frame and say, one of these people is the doctor, one of these is the fighter, and one of these is the educator. Who was who?
Yes.
And you could assign them because they play the roles with an air to them that immediately makes them iconic, almost like chess pieces for this game that's about to be played on the board that is Arrakis.
And thanks to their training as actors and their capabilities, the elevated language and the elevated presence this calls for, it all seems very natural, as if, yeah, that is how people in the service of a great house talk to one another and to their liege.
Yeah, this is a movie, but I will say, the fight scenes of multiple men are not great. The fight scenes of one-on-one fights are very well done.
Yeah, the battle scenes, I almost think that there were production limitations. They were not as impressive as they were supposed to be. But even though the brief depictions we get of shield technology, I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah.
It was hand-done animation over film, from what I understand. But it was very effective and very good.
The grand paintings, the grand map paintings we see of locations for establishing shots are so excellent, and the characterizations are so elevated properly. This feels like a stage play of Dune that happens to be filmed in some ways more than a film of Dune.
Yes, and another way that I kind of took this, some of the paintings and things that happened, some of the spacecraft and the way they depicted the Guild Highliners in orbit and things, and some of the depictions of the cities, it almost looked like the illustrations you'd get in a big, beautifully produced book. Like I'm there reading this saga of this great family, and I get to this page that has a beautiful illustration. Is it photographic? No. And were the paintings and things that were incorporated into the movie photographic? Were they going to fool me into thinking it was actually shot on film? No. But they still had the right impact, and I liked that.
Just imagining comparisons between this version of Dune now and Neverending Story. You know, main character rides giant local creature in iconic scene. Yep, it's Neverending Spice Mines.
Oh, it's time for, you've seen this actor before, by the way.
Oh, yes.
Francesca Annis plays Lady Jessica.
Okay.
A year before, she played the Widow of the Web in Krull.
That was
the Spider Lady.
Oh, goodness. Okay. Hey. My Krull connection worked. Yay.
So we've talked about the casting and the characterizations of many of the characters in the House Atreides.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about Jose Ferrer as the Emperor. I think he did a fine job. Sometimes I had the impression that Jose Ferrer didn't quite understand the movie he was in, but was such a pro, he was giving a good performance anyway.
Yes. I will say, for the Emperor and for a lot of this, that stage play element means that the set design did a lot of work.
Oh, yes.
His grand opulence of his chair and his costume make the complacent power that he is supposed to represent solid enough. Just seeing all the miniatures of the ships fly through, and then when we see his, it's the same miniature, gold-plated, and it's like, that feels overdone and excessive and power show-offy in the right way for this character.
And so much of the design was good. It was really powerful, really effective, and I think every bit of money they spent seemed to be there on the screen. I thought, as you say, the design for everything about the Emperor and his court, very, very good. I thought the design around House Atreides and the palace on Arrakis that they were moving into, I thought that design was great. So much of that just fit what I imagined reading the book so well.
Even the costuming, for most parts, did well at keeping them different.
Yes.
The cutscene from watching the Atreides leaving their home, getting on the ship, and they're in their furs and their thick wool uniforms in the rain and everything.
Yes, all the dark colors.
All the dark colors. And then when they arrive on Arrakis, it's them in the exact same line. And Jessica's wearing an airy dress, and both Leto and Paul are wearing these light khaki versions of the same cut, but obviously a lighter, desert-ready version. And just the shot of us in a line when we're at home, getting on the ship scene, which is the ship scene. I'm just going to skip over that. And then paralleling that with the ship comes down and them in the exact same line again was great storytelling of showing them being ready, but showing their style having to adapt.
Yes, this is still House Atreides, but they are no longer House Atreides of Caladan. They are House Atreides of Arrakis, and they are ready to be that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I thought that was well done, and a lot of the costuming, very well done. I thought the depiction of still suits, very, very good, very accurate to the description of the book. It was believable without being distracting.
The one group I say they didn't do costuming great for was Harkonnen.
Yes, that brings this whole movie down, crashing so many levels.
Yes.
The decisions made about how to portray as Harkonnen they just seemed like they were simplistic and cheap and easy and based on maybe it was one of those things that makes me think a lot of about this movie was based upon a skimming of the book as opposed to an immersion in the book. Because the Harkonnens in the book, they were incredibly wealthy and they were incredibly crafty. Their evil and their craft and their treachery was hidden behind a veneer of wealth and civility.
And meanwhile, we've got characters that are living in what looks like a meat processing plant.
Yes.
And gone bad. And the movie I'm going to reference is only made 4 years later, but they read so much more like the bullies from the future in Back to the Future 2 than they did an intimidating force of a rival house to deal with these Atreides.
It didn't
click.
So much of it is summed up in the fact that they've got Baron Harkonnen floating around in the air.
Like the fizzy lifting drinks scene.
Yes. And I know I ranted about this in prior podcasts about the other Dune properties, but the book makes it very clear that this was to disguise something. He wore a suspensor. He was incredibly corpulent, but he wore a suspensor harness under his clothes to reduce his weight so he could walk around with a nimble step.
Yeah.
It was hidden. Made him appear to be something he wasn't. It wasn't, I'm gonna float around and do pinwheels in the air.
And laugh. Somehow, instead of crafty manipulator, we wind up with a villain from Captain Planet in the middle of the go fly a kite scene from Mary Poppins.
And so much of the rest of House Harkonnen and their planet Gedi Prime, it was all just repulsive grotesquerie and body horror and all of these things that aren't necessary. You don't need to do that to convince us that this house is evil. It goes against so much of what's at the core of Dune. When you get down to it, a lot about Dune is that 10,000 years in the future, these people, at least the people of these great houses, they are, by our standards, already super beings. They have incredible long lives. They have incredibly high intelligence. And this is a clash among super beings. And the Kwisatz Haderach is going to be the super being among super beings, species-wide. But everything about the Harkonnens is just ugly and brutal and disgusting and simple-seeming. And they're repulsive without being scary.
To pull a sentence about this kind of presentation from Kyle Kalgren, hi, I'm Dr. Bad Guy. I'll be your bad guy for the evening. Yes. Allow me to bad guy a little.
Right.
It's very, very overt and hits you over the head. And for a thing that's already this bewildering sight and sound thing, to have something so flat actually makes everything else more discordant.
And David Lynch is too quick to lean into repulsiveness and body horror as a marker for evil. This is a prime example of that.
A Gedi prime example.
And there are a few other things that make me wonder if the people designing things for this movie really, really read and understood the book very well. Ornithopters, for example. They don't have flappy wings. They have little stubby wings, and they're just kind of levitation boxes.
Yeah.
I don't quite get that.
I don't.
Ornithopter means a thing. It's maybe they're limited by what they could do in film in 1984, but still.
It meant a thing enough that you handed everyone a sheet of paper explaining what the thing you didn't do right was.
Yes. And yet, whenever there were no Harkonnens on screen, I was still pulled in. I was still pulled in by the conversations between Paul and his father, between them and Liet Kynes.
Were you pulled in, though, when we saw the Navigation Guild leader navigate?
Well, I don't know. What did you think of that casting?
It's nice to see Oscar the Grouch have some other roles.
Yeah, that was, again,
that was a weird puppet.
It also was, with the body horror.
Also with the body horror. And I'm going to say something that's a little spoilery for the grander Dune lore. Like, the books I haven't read, but I've read and heard discussions of.
Now, I haven't read any more than the first three or four ones that Frank Herbert wrote.
There's implications, apparently, in later things that enough spice could turn you into one of the worms.
Oh, well, yeah, there is that.
They kind of actually made that more prevalent in the way they designed this guy.
I
guess, by doing the little three-part mouth like the worms have?
I hadn't thought of that.
Is that them being very forward-thinking and clever? Or very not? I don't know.
When I thought of guild navigators in their tanks of spice gas, I always thought of them as just kind of dudes who were three-quarters of the way to being creature of the Black Lagoon-ish with a little bit of gray alien thrown in.
Yeah.
But still kind of humanish and human size and humanoid. Not this bizarre wormish floating monstrosity, yeah. But you're right. That they could have been looking ahead.
They might be. I don't know. I don't know if I'm giving this too much credit there.
I'm happy to give them credit where I can, so I like that.
I do appreciate that apparently like the aesthetic style they chose was like old-timey radio and trains. Because he shows up in a train car and then they've got this old like, well, what do you know? Hello there! Kind of microphone in front of him, and it works. I kind of wish they gave him that voice. You're going to kill Paul Atreides, right? Hello!
I'm your guild navigator, sponsored by Lucky Strike.
Exactly.
Now in spice flavor. So yeah, the guild navigators, there's a whole lot of body horror around there,
and we
entourage as well.
We do get to see them, like, floating around and manipulating the giant cosmic Jenga piece in order to fly from place to place.
One thing I have to acknowledge, there's one guy in the entourage of the guild navigator who goes into to meet the emperor at the beginning. Not the guy with the tube stuck in his head and the microphone and all that, but there, as they leave... This tank leaks because there's this pool of a gross liquid that's kind of left behind.
Thinking of the guy with the Hoover?
Yeah, there's one guy with the nozzle of a shop vac kind of just giving a cursory swipe to the ground. It's like he's not touching a tenth of the spooge that's been left on the emperor's floor by this thing, but you know, he got the job, his uncle set it up for him, so he's got to make it look good. It's just like, does that guy take any satisfaction in his work? If he did, he'd be moving faster and have a bigger vacuum.
I don't know. That's one of those moments, though, where it's an obvious actual real-world vacuum. And I will say, there are moments here where if you're a prop and costuming and set design fan like I am, you will notice stuff. There is a guy in the back during that, like, the start of that same scene, behind the guy talking, who just has a black kazoo in his mouth. And I'm just here thinking, like, it, and with all of his headgear and everything else, it looks futuristic, but I can see the little white disc on the top where the buzzer is. And I'm just imagining him just agreeing to stuff, like, but I'm, like, these little tiny things, these small moments. If you're looking for them, it's easy to pull yourself out of this.
Yes.
But if you let it wash over you, it's all cohesive.
My reaction to the battle scene with the fall of Arrakis to when the Harkonnens, supported by Sardaukar, attack, it was a different reaction than it was in 1984 because the attacking troops were all in these, they looked kind of like radiation suits or something. They were head to toe with a big hood and a big glass faceplate and some kind of green mist behind them. And I guess that was the Harkonnen battle uniform because they were supposed to be hiding the fact that there were Sardaukar. But I looked at these shapeless forms with just the big rounded rectangle faceplate thing. And I'm thinking, it's Among Us.
Oh, yes. I love that.
The Sardaukar has been ejected.
Oh, goodness. There was even a story of a traitor in this. Yes. So, yes, this is the Among Us movie, people.
And so that was another one where, gosh, you didn't have a lot of money. You needed a lot of these costumes. So you had to make them cheap. So they're made of...
Whatever.
Like pet doors and duct tape.
Yeah. But it works. It works.
Yeah, kind of. Know. They didn't that seem same as scary as they're supposed to me.
No, but in that same stage play-y kind of way, when a man walks up in a costume that you're getting a fuzzy shot of from where you are, and everyone can respond with the right horror, the right elevated stage horror.
Okay.
You can give gravitas to something that its image alone does not have.
Yeah. These and are scary, not just because they look scary, but because the characters I trust are treating them as scary.
And so when Patrick Stewart there is standing there with five men behind him and he sees one of these walking through with explosions, and his response is to pause and give a rallying cry before they charge, suddenly what they're charging at seems more dangerous than its image alone. And that's where it works. If you focus on any one part, this will crumble. But if you let it wash over you.
And it wasn't just Gurney with five guys behind him. It was Gurney with five guys and the dog. Gotta protect that dog.
There's a lot more dogs in this movie.
Yes.
There's a lot of dogs in Dune Space.
It's as almost as if that is a mark of nobility, is being able to keep and breed animals.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the casting was, and the characterizations were uneven, sometimes very good, sometimes just horrible, and that brings the whole movie down. And that leaves the story, and the structure of the story. And again, I think you're right that they did a pretty good job in, say, the first third, up until they meet the Fremen in the desert.
Who just kind of like, oh, sweet, you're part of us now.
Yeah, for one thing, now I can't look at Stilgar and not think, hey, it's Big Ed, going to take it back to the gas farm. Watched a little too much Twin Peaks. But still, yeah, Everett McGill is a fine actor, but I don't look at him and say, this is someone who has lived his entire life in the harsh desert, leading a people who have been honed into mighty warriors by brutal necessity. I just don't see that in this actor.
The Fremen come off a little more street gang than I expected.
Where you
show up and you immediately best one of them in hand-to-hand, and they're like, ah, dang, want to join?
It's a little combination of street gang and 70s heavy metal bands.
Yes!
And that reminds me, the music in this movie.
Actually, very cool.
I think the music is good. Most of the music is by Toto.
Okay.
Who got tired of writing him at Rain, I guess. And also a song.
What? I try to not crack like that, but you got me with that one.
And one song by Brian Eno. So I thought the music was very good. Beautiful, like four or five note musical theme beginning it.
Yeah.
At the beginning. But the story, it's sort of, they get to Stilgar and then it starts to get a little bit by the numbers.
Yeah.
Then we get to the point where it's, oh my gosh, we got a lot of story and not enough time. We better hurry up. And they rush through and we get another voiceover from Irulan talking about what happened over the next 2 years.
Yeah.
And then suddenly Paul is the leader of the Fremen armies.
Very different. Also, because of that sped up thing, his sister doesn't get a lot of establishment. She just kind of is talked about and shown kind of creepily, and then shows up and is even creepier.
Yes.
And there's no
perfunctory creepiness.
Yeah. Like, hi, I'm small and creepy. Yes. That's my role.
Very effectively small and creepy.
Absolutely. She's just like evil Navi, though.
Just not.
Hey, listen. Look.
Oh, I like that. And I thought the final battles were pretty good.
Yeah.
The depiction of the sandworms and the breaking through the shield wall with the atomics. And they don't take time to explain the weird political military issue around not being able to use atomics as a weapon. But none of the rules don't say I can't use it to break down mountains.
Yeah. And the worms are very well shown. Their puppets for it, their scenes for it are great. Some of it's silly because you got that obvious green screen layering for the scale aspect.
There's a lot of that with the spaceships and the worms, and the compositing is not really done very smoothly.
And some of the tech looks silly sometimes. I did like in the final battle that all of the Emperor's highest command apparently sit on, like, the battle merry-go-round, which is this spinning set of seats with the laser cannon guides.
It reminded me of an arcade game called, I think it was Invasion UFO.
Okay.
Let's see if I can find a picture of that.
But. For all we know, it's a couple of those consoles strapped together. Who knows? Also, then we get scenes from their perspective, and it seems less like the worms are strong and more that the worms are unexpected. It's like, no one was ready.
Combination there.
It's less that these things are actually hard to deal with and more just like, oh, dang, we weren't ready for a worm.
And they're just big.
Big.
And there's something else that aids Paul and the Fremen armies in their battle.
Yeah.
And that is the Weirding Modules.
The Weirding Modules.
The Weirding Modules, which I had absolutely no idea why and how and what is this doing in this movie. They're not necessary. The book includes the idea that the Bene Gesserit, among all their other training, have some special combat training. And Jessica and Paul pass this along to the Fremen to make their armies even more powerful, because if they are trained in these special combat techniques, not only are they big, not only are they tough, they're now incredibly capable. It's a passing along of knowledge. And instead, we get the fact that the Atreides were developing this new kind of weapon that was about transforming sounds into destructive energy. And they build more of these and they arm the Fremen with them.
Complicated, ancient way of fighting? There's an app for that.
Now, today, as I watch this again in 2023, the reason why that's in the movie, at least I understand why I believe that's in the movie. And that has to do with David Lynch and his very strong devotion and practice for transcendental meditation.
You're kidding me.
I'm not. And it's some specific terms that are put into the mouth of the character Paul, some specific bits of dialogue as he's explaining these to the Fremen. Without going into a whole thing about this, transcendental meditation is, maybe among other things, a kind of meditation that uses a mantra, a sound thought form, a sound or spoken syllable or set of syllables it's not really vocalized, it's just thought about as a focus during meditation. But there's this idea in transcendental meditation that there's a connection between sounds and thought forms and how they interact in the mind. And they had Paul saying specific things about certain sounds are connected to thought forms and they can come into the world to have power. So much of it sounded right out of transcendental meditation. I think that was something that David Lynch put in there because he wanted a movie, and why not this movie, to embody something of his understanding and appreciation for transcendental meditation. I think that's the only reason I can think of to add this otherwise completely superfluous thing of the Weirding Modules.
That makes a lot of sense, because without that context, they are just voice-activated laser guns.
Yes, they're pew-pew, where you actually have to say pew-pew.
Which is kind of awesome, I must say, in its own way.
Yeah, now that I think about that, that's not bad. Cool.
Better than the apparent hip-thrust Gatling guns we also see them use, which is just, what? Okay.
Yeah, I guess those are the stage 2 or stage 3 Weirding Modules.
Yeah, but it makes sense, and it does, it's another piece of shortcut where the speed of the story can accelerate.
Yeah, but I don't know, I think everybody has seen enough martial arts movies that you could have a little training montage and not need the extra complication of what there's another technology we have to deal with.
I do want to add the thing of I loved the bit where it's this obelisk is made of your hardest stone. Punch it, kick it, kick it, cut it. No one can do anything to it. My thought, then how'd you build the obelisk?
Yes.
Then Paul blows it up to show how powerful the gun is. But I'm like, they obviously have something good enough to cut and shape this.
So we need an army of stone cutters, is what you're telling us?
That was just one of my moments. One of those, you poke it too much, falls apart things.
And then, after the big battle, and we have the face-off between Paul and Sting. Aid, played by Sting.
Yeah, where Sting decides to do, like, jumping jack karate.
That was pretty good casting, I thought. Sting as Fade.
Yeah.
He was a little bit too coked up seeming as he was, it's like
you could
the spice versus the coke.
Yeah. Cinnamony taste. Yeah. Okay.
But you know, that was that last knife fight between them. It was kind of, well, we've got to include it, so we'll include it. And then Paul is recognized as the Kwisatz Haderach, and they talk about the fact that he's now going to spread an empire of peace, love, and understanding throughout the universe, which very different from the book. And I guess because he's the Kwisatz Haderach now and has superpowers, it starts raining.
Yeah.
On Arrakis.
Yeah.
They show earlier that the Fremen have been collecting water and wind traps. They don't really acknowledge how much of that was Liet Kynes's plan for them, but they were collecting this water, and eventually when they have enough, they can change the face of Arrakis. And what does this mean, that they happened to have enough to create storm clouds just as he became the Kwisatz Haderach? He teleported their supplies into the air because he became the Kwisatz Haderach? Or is everything they were doing moot and superfluous because he's just a super being and can do what he wants with rain?
Don't worry, people. Simba's back on Pride Rock. I mean, Paul's the Kwisatz Haderach. That's what we get.
Yeah, pretty much. It was too much of a, well, it's a desert planet that's supposed to be saved by him. What does that mean? Oh, yeah, rain. You know, it's, you can be more subtle. You can be more thoughtful. You can be more, I don't know, you can be more grown up than having to go to a rainstorm as the opposite of a desert.
As my first action as grand super ruler, super being of this place, I say that the local ecology can get right out of here.
Yes, exactly.
Who cares?
Yeah.
I liked it back home.
Yeah, let's not forget about the fact that they did talk about the secret that was eventually revealed of the fact that there's a connection between the worms and the spice. And they never go into detail about what that is. But it seems to me that if suddenly Arrakis is a rainy place, that the worms are not going to do very well.
Yep.
And that was something that Kynes had to be thoughtful about in the plan that he creates. But the movie just throws all of that away.
I bless the rains down on Arrakis. Songs by Toto.
And also, the one thing that they just unnecessarily got wrong was Paul taking the water of life and surviving, and that leading to him being the Kwisatz Haderach.
Yeah.
Instead of it being in the Fremen siege, they have him like go out into the desert and Chani feed him the water of life, and he has a trip that was reminiscent to me of Altered States.
Very reminiscent of Altered States.
And the
worms show up,
show up to watch and sing back.
Yeah, sing back up. That's exactly what I'm thinking. It's like the worm chorus arrives.
It's
Paul Atreides and the worm backup dances.
No, I didn't see a reason for that change. I don't know what that got us, except a pretty cool Brian Eno song.
Yeah.
Well, we are heading towards our final questions.
Yep.
So stay tuned for those. But first, if you would like more of the Intermillennium Media Project, please go to www.immproject.com. And that's where you will find all of our past episodes, including our episode discussing Frank Herbert's novel, Dune, and a bonus episode discussing the part one of the Denis Villeneuve movies. And you will also find a link to our Patreon, where you can support us. I can inflict more old movies on Ian, and you can get more bonus audio content, and also a link to our store, where you can buy t-shirts and coffee mugs and fun things like that. And more important, a link to our Discord and our contact page, because we would really love to hear from you. Have you seen this David Lynch movie, and what did you think about it? What did you think of the Harkonnens? Are we being too hard on the designers for that? And Ian, where can people find you?
I can be found at itemcrafting.com or itemcrafting live on Twitch and itemcrafting on YouTube.
And you can find me at bymatthewporter.com. It'll have a link to anything I'm doing online, including my YouTube channel, where you will find the Drafthouse diary with a record of every one of my visits to the Alamo Drafthouse.
Including the one that counted for this movie. So if you wanted to hear about what we ate during it, you can hear from my dad all about the rest of our trip to the Alamo to go see Dune.
That's very true. So, David Lynch's 1984 Dune. Screen or no screen?
I'm surprised to hear myself say screen. I am surprised to hear myself say screen, because there's enough little bits in here I liked, and there's enough wildness to run with in other directions. This is not a great thing to watch screen. This is a, do you want to immediately, like, light a fire under some aspect of your creative self? Go watch David Lynch's Dune and then sit down to work on whatever you're doing. If you love it, you'll have inspiration. If you hate it, you'll have pathways the opposite direction to go. And you'll know what you're like. It'll help give you that focus. I think it's useful.
I'm going to say no screen.
Wow. Okay.
It's just, my summary of this movie is that it is a glorious failure. There is so much that is beautiful about it, so much that is innovative, so much of it is that is exciting, and seeing it on a big screen really impressed me in some scenes. And yet, it's not a good movie. It totally falls apart. What is bad about it just denigrates everything that was good about it. I'm going to say no screen with a couple of exceptions. If you really want this for purposes of having that film history under your belt, yeah, watch it. If you are a completist when it comes to David Lynch, or maybe Kyle MacLachlan, yeah, go ahead and watch it. But on its own merits, I just can't recommend it. If you really feel the need to watch it, you can't not watch it, consider finding the Alan Smithy version.
Okay.
Because a few years after this came out and was a failure in the box office, a new cut was made. I think it was a longer version. I believe it was made specifically for television. And it added more prologue. It used some, I believe, pre-production sketches to give you more background about the civilization. They talk about the Butlerian jihad that eliminated all computers and thinking machines, which isn't even mentioned in the David Lynch version of this movie. And in some ways, it's a little more comprehensible. It flows a little better. And yet, it wasn't what David Lynch had put together and wanted to put together, so he wouldn't put his name on it as director. So that's why it went out as an Alan Smithy film. But overall, I'd say, you know, I cannot recommend a screening this. I don't know that David Lynch would either. This was a turning point, a critical turning point in David Lynch's career, because it's the one film in his entire career in which he did not have the rights to the final cut. He did not have the right to do a final edit. The studio and the producer, Raffaella De Laurentiis, had the ability to veto and make changes to the edit. And I don't... It was, I think, the biggest budget movie he ever made, because after that, he was willing to make movies on smaller budgets because he insisted on final cut. He didn't make anything this big, this epic again. So this really changed the course of his career. And he feels that it was a selling out from the very beginning to agree to do this movie without having final cut. And the results just cemented that. So things would have been very different for David Lynch and his career if this movie had succeeded.
Wow. So I was talking earlier about how the concept of David Lynch as a creator was kind of established with this being a part of it. But this kind of was the start of what I now know of as him in that sense.
As a final film, it's the least David Lynch of any David Lynch movie.
Okay. Interesting. Well... our other question is a little bit of an odd one.
Yes.
It's revive, reboot, or rest in peace.
And that's always odd for an adaptation anyway, because, well, revive would be in the same continuity as the David Lynch movie, and that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
But reboot would just be another adaptation of Dune, and we've had
We're getting
those.
That. Yeah.
We've had a couple of those.
Yeah.
there was a two-part sci-fi channel adaptation of Dune.
Oh, really?
Around a little more than 20 years ago, I believe.
2001-ish?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that was odd and interesting and very stage play-ish. A lot that it got wrong, but it was an interesting effort.
Okay.
And now, of course, we've got the Denis Villeneuve movies.
Yeah. It would be interesting to see someone try to use the later Dune books and the way that this one so changes and ends weirdly and see, like, the what would happen if you were to write one of the later books' attempted story progressions in the Lynch world, in the David Lynch version, but I don't know if that's good.
Yeah, I don't know how they would do it given the way this movie ends, but there's something in me that is so curious about what David Lynch would have done with God Emperor of Dune and the giant sandworm Leto Atreides.
Yeah. I think I'm going to say rest in peace.
Yeah, I'm going to have to say rest in peace to the 1984 David Lynch version of Dune.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to seeing the part two of Villeneuve's version.
Same. Honestly, the fact that this is continuing to get adapted, that this is still this, you know, wildly dense, hard nut to crack that people are taking swings at, is wonderful.
It is.
And I'm excited by that fact. And I think that the new ones are doing well, but that doesn't mean people aren't going to try again or keep going. So who knows?
Oh, sure. I think the book is going to be around for a long time, and it's some of its ideas are so fundamental that successive generations find new things to pull out of them to pay attention to. It was an ecological novel when it was written decades ago. It's still an ecological novel, but I think people in the 2020s are seeing different impacts of different aspects of that ecological story.
Yeah.
Than were seen in the 1960s. So I think that's going to continue. And I think that people are going to continue to adapt it. I look forward to not only part two of Villeneuve's Dune, but I'm really curious as to whether they're going to let him continue with the other Frank Herbert books, because I'd be interested to see what he does with those as well.
Oh, yeah. So.
And the Parade of Duncan Idaho's.
Yes. Jason Momoa everywhere. Yay.
But I think that's all for this episode of the Intermillennium Media Project podcast. Thank you very much for listening. We really appreciate it. We will be back with more tales of media from the 20th century.
In the meantime, go find something new to watch. Wait a minute, Dad, this is a movie about a man raised with a strong work ethic who then builds himself an empire and a foundation on the imagery of a mouse.
Yeah.
And this was released by Universal and Warner Brothers, the two times I've seen it in movie theaters. Just noting that. Feels like the other company.